Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we have my friend Will Buxton back, NBCSN's Formula One pit lane reporter. Talk about Fernando Alonso, his reaction to, well, Will's reaction, not Fernando's, but Will's reaction to the announcement of Alonso coming to the Indy 500 with Andretti Autosport, McLaren, and Honda. Will had a fairly passionate response as well to a ill-formed, ill-conceived, and short-sighted opinion piece written by an American reporter who maybe doesn't realize that a world exists outside of our lovely country. So it was interesting to hear Will's thoughts on that. Also spoke about possible destinations for Fernando if he chooses to leave McLaren at the end of the year. I know that there are some rumors out there where he might head. Will had some great insights there as well. Delved into one of my theories about why the Mercedes team has been looking rather brand new this year, at least through three rounds. Obviously, they were able to win the second round, but I have a strong belief that with the lack of engine dominance that they've used in recent years to, frankly, just overwhelm the field with speed, that they have suffered and really, frankly, have not had to develop their race strategy. Now that we're seeing Ferrari with a car that has the speed to match in race trim, I'm fairly confident, and I believe we're seeing the fact that Ferrari's had to be really smart, really canny, really, really intelligent when it comes to their race strategy planning in recent years while suffering overall vehicle deficiency, but also definitely in the engine department. They're putting that to good use. Now that they have a really strong car, something that can fight the Mercedes, guess what? The team that has had to think their way into podium finishes is now putting one over on the team that I don't think has really had to dig that deep to get the results that they have gotten. So Will gave me his thoughts as to whether he believes I am right or wrong there. We also closed on his look through the opening portion of the year, how these three races have gone, any surprises so far on the positive or negative side. So always good to catch up with Will. He's become a fairly regular voice here in the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, and as we're trying to do more Formula One, a sport that I've loved and followed since I was a wee lad, it's great to have folks who are on pit lane talking to all of the stars, all of the engineers, team owners, team managers, people that are making the sport happen, provide a little bit of insight that I don't get to do myself. So, with all that said, off we go with Will Buxton.
We've had a fairly fun week. Some Spanish guy, I believe, is going to come to Indianapolis. Not sure what he's going to do while he's there. Maybe take the bus ride tour around the place.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yes.
I haven't heard this story.
We've got one F. Alonso coming over. That's awesome. I'd love to get your thoughts on how that has resonated on the F1 side, having just come from Bahrain doing your reporting with our friends at NBCSN. We obviously have Force India's founder in the news today, which is a little bit unfortunate. And we also have some negative thoughts on the impact of Mr. Alonso, which I'd love to get your thoughts on. And also want to pick your brain on a Mercedes theory. So why don't we start on one F. Alonso and what you felt, saw, and heard throughout the paddock in Bahrain.
I thought it was a joke when it first came through. I had no idea. Obviously, you knew. You'd been working on it for quite a while, as it turned out. You know, could have let me know, mate.
Thanks. Sorry, my bad.
It's just incredible. This is something that I've been talking to Fernando about in interviews. I seem to recall, even since the speed days, I think, but maybe certainly very early on in the NBCSN days, it was something that I put to Fernando. I think Austrian Grand Prix, maybe 2014.
Wow.
Were we racing in Austria in 2014?
Sure.
I think we were.
If not, we'll make
and,
it up.
And he was like, yeah, I want to do it. And I think that was the year that he was actually at Le Mans with Ferrari, waving the flag. And he was like, yeah, I want to do Le Mans. I want to do the 500. There's all this stuff that I want to do. And I was like, that's cool. You got to do it. And it was around the time, of course, that he was due to go and do Le Mans with Porsche, but then Ferrari said, no, you can't. And so Nico Hülkenberg went and did it and ended up winning it. And, you know, it's pretty well known that, you know, Hülkenberg basically won the Le Mans that Alonso felt he should have won, because that was his seat. So I think there's always been this urge in him to get the Triple Crown. And as time has gone on, and the McLaren Honda dream is turning into a nightmare. You know, he wanted to take that back to the top. He wanted to do with McLaren Honda what, you know, what Michael did with Ferrari, and, you know, recreate the legend. And with this going so badly wrong, I think he has seen his opportunity of A, recreating that legacy, that incredible partnership. I think he sees that slipping away. With it goes his opportunity of winning more world championships. He's always said he wanted a third, and he would quit after a third. But I think he sees that slipping away. And I think McLaren thought, well, we're going to lose this guy if we don't give him something that will keep him with us. And if that is the Indy 500, and we can work something out that he can do the 500, then we've got to do it, or we're going to lose him. So I think that's kind of how it all came about. It seems to have happened very quickly and amazing. I mean, obviously, if you're Mark Miles and Zach Brown phones you up and says, hey, so I've got a guy that kind of wants to do the 500 and, you know, it's too time for me, then you say, yes, how do we do this? So it's great. It's great. And honestly, what's amazing, I've been researching over the last week, you know, looking at Google statistics and all of that. And Indy 500 and Fernando Alonso were searched more in the 5 days leading up to the Bahrain Grand Prix than Bahrain Grand Prix.
Wow.
So that's kind of huge. My Twitter feed exploded. I got 500,000 impressions on the Wednesday of the announcement. And bear in mind that, like, I think the best day I'd ever had in my life up to then was like 100,000 impressions.
Jeez.
Shows you the kind of interaction that was going on, the interest from around the world. And that's the incredible thing, is when you look at the searches for the Indy 500, America doesn't even rank top 10. Like, Spain is number one, UK, Netherlands, Australia, I think Brazil's in there. So, like, places that don't normally search or have any interest in the Indy 500 all of a sudden are searching for it, wanting to know about it. I've had people tweet me, emailing me, saying, I haven't been to the Indy 500 in 20 years and I'm going to go. Mm. People saying I would drive through the night because I want to go and see Fernando. I think it's a win for IndyCar, because I think Fernando is going to turn up and find it really hard. So it's a win for IndyCar. It's going to get bums on seats. It's going to get people around the world watching. I already know of Formula One crews who will not be in Monaco this year because they're going to be at Indianapolis following Fernando. You know, it's a huge win for Formula One stateside, because the IndyCar broadcasts are all going to be talking about this. The magazines, the websites will be talking about this. And then I can't see how it doesn't get discussed then on NASCAR broadcasts, because it's not, you know, they've had drivers go and do the 500. Obviously, you've got Bush, you know, when did, and so many others. But at the same time, you had Lewis turning around this weekend and saying, well, I don't want to do the Indy 500, but I'd sure as hell do the Daytona 500. So, you know, it's opened up all of this discussion, and that will get NASCAR fans, IndyCar fans talking about Formula One. And that's a real positive for Formula One stateside. And it's a positive to McLaren, because they're having a pretty crap year again. And it finally throws some goodwill their way, that they are allowing this driver who's being wasted an opportunity to do something awesome. Don't know if you can tell, but I'm really excited.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's one thing for us in America to look at and offer opinions on whether Alonso will be a big deal or not, or whether choosing a driver from a domestic series would have had a bigger pop. But I think those who look at Alonso coming to Indy as a missed opportunity for IndyCar to grab major headlines, or, you know, maybe failing to realize that outside of our lovely borders, there's a Formula One mad world that has not had a reason to really pay big attention to the Indy 500 or IndyCar for decades. It happened to be at Laguna Seca, the season finale in 92, standing on the outside of Turn 11 taking photographs, and looked across and saw Nigel Mansell on the inside of the corner, and A, shat my pants because he was the reigning world champion, but also said to myself, what in the world is Mansell doing here? And having seen the massive, massive impact that he had, the massive interest that came as a result of him moving to IndyCar in 93 and 94, not saying Fernando is going to recreate that the same level of interest by a one-off in May, but at least having seen what a giant F1 star has done to bring international interest to IndyCar, I have to believe someone of Fernando's caliber can help.
Could you imagine, you know, 92, 93, if social media had been around, what the impact would have been of Nigel being at, you know, as you said, at Laguna Seca watching that, and you know, what the reaction would have been to that. It's completely crazy. I remember, you know, the only reason that we ever got IndyCar broadcast in the UK was because Nigel went over to do it in the United States. And I remember, you know, my first contact with IndyCar was watching in the middle of the night, you know, watching Nigel racing. That was my first introduction to it. And for a lot of people, you know, this will be their introduction to IndyCar. It will, you know, a lot of people in Europe who've never watched it, never had any desire to watch it, will tune in. A lot of European countries don't have a broadcaster for the Indy 500, and all of a sudden there's this interest for it. So I do think it's great for IndyCar. I really do. I think IndyCar can be quite insular. It can be quite narrowly focused on, you know, what's right for America and what's right for, you know, Indiana and the sort of the inhabitants of Indianapolis. But it's bigger than that. You know, IndyCar is an international series with international drivers that has international interest, and it should be watched around the world because it is a brilliant racing championship that we know because we love racing and we're, you know, invested and embedded in it. We know how good IndyCar is. But sometimes you know, I spend a lot of my time in Europe, obviously, and you come up to people who say, hey, what's an IndyCar race like? You know, is it any good? You're like, are you kidding me? You've got to go. You know, and even Fernando doesn't know what to expect. You know, the guy who's going to the 500, he doesn't know anything about the series because he's never been to a race. And this is a two-time Formula One world champion, so how can a regular fan get a feel for it? But I think it's great for IndyCar, man. I think it's huge.
I'm with you. Well, sticking with Alonso for a moment, watching Bahrain last weekend, looking at him, you know, performing miracles in the twisty bits where the deficiencies of his power unit were not fully exposed. You know, there was some chatter of if he were to leave McLaren, you know, would Renault be an option? I know this is stupid, but you know, I look at what Vettel is achieving. I look at Kimi, who I love, but I have not believed that Kimi has gotten the same amount out of his Ferrari as Vettel has.
Yeah.
There's just a part of me that says, good Lord, going to Renault would probably, it would depress me. It'd be a better situation for him. But to your point, you know, I want to see him win that third world championship so he can retire in peace. But I look at some of the other high quality cars that are maybe not being driven to 100% at every single round and wonder, do you think he has a chance anywhere else?
Dream is Mercedes, isn't it? You know, yeah. The dream is that he goes to Mercedes and he hooks up with Lewis and we finally get that battle royale, because I think deep down Lewis would like him, because, you know, Lewis, in the one season that they were teammates, they finished level on points. And that was Lewis's first season in Formula One. And, you know, Lewis knows that he's a better, more complete racing driver now. Fernando, we're a decade down the line, and you know, Fernando's arguably putting in some of his finest performances in F1 to drag that terrible car up into the points until it breaks down on him. And I think it would be great. I think both drivers would relish the opportunity to go wheel to wheel again and be teammates again and once and for all answer that question of who's the best. It would be awesome. I can't see him heading back to Ferrari. You know, the Renault, I believe there is an offer on the table from Renault, but I think there always is. I think Fernando's probably got an office at Enstone that's never been cleared out, because every time things go wrong, he ends up back at Enstone. It's like, I tweeted a photo the other day, a scene from Officer and a Gentleman, you know, when Richard Gere's sitting there and he's getting shouted at by the drill sergeant, and he's just like, I got no place else to go. And that's kind of Fernando with Enstone. Every time everything goes wrong, he ends up back at Enstone. But, yeah, I'd love to see him at Mercedes. I think everyone would. Whether that's realistic or not, I don't know. And who knows? You know, maybe he goes to the Brickyard and gets so much fever for IndyCar that actually he doesn't come back to Formula One and he turns up with Andretti Autosport in 2018. That would be great.
Well, I'm going to talk to Zach Brown here shortly, and one of the things I'm going to float to him is how do we pay Fernando the same salary to drive an IndyCar? Because I think once we get that figured out, we know where he's going to spend the next...
Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing. If Toto Wolff had turned around at the end of 2017, and said... Hey, Fernando, listen, we want you to drive for us next year, but it's going to cost us so much to break you out of your McLaren contract that all we can do is give you a bottle of Rioja. I think Fernando would have gone, yeah, that's cool. All Fernando wants is to race. You know, I think he's made more money than he'll ever spend. I don't think he'd need a stupid amount to be... If he went over and loved it and thought there was a chance that he could win the Indy 500 and be competitive and maybe go and do Le Mans on the back of it or whatever, you know, Yeah, he'd want a salary, but I don't think he'd want $20 million a year or anything.
You could kind of buy half the grid for that, if not more.
Well, exactly, but that's what I'm saying. You know, he's used to getting a big Formula One salary. But right now, the point in life that he's at, I think he just wants to race, man. I think he just wants to be competitive and have fun. And that's the thing for him. You know, he's putting... Let's not forget, going to the Indy 500 and turning up and doing what he's doing, he's putting his reputation on the line. And he has a reputation as one of the best, fastest, most competitive drivers, not just in Formula One, but in the world. And if he turns up at Indianapolis and flunks out of rookie orientation because he can't go fast enough, that's a massive embarrassment. But that's the risk. And I don't think enough people have really appreciated the risk that he's taking to his reputation by going out there. But he has been bashed. Sorry, I'll just throw that in there. And I don't get that. I didn't get that. That did my head in. Anyway, moving on.
So looking at the F1 season so far, I've been holding on to a theory, and I don't know, after Bahrain, I definitely think, after Australia, and then also now after Bahrain, I have a growing theory that the Mercedes team is finding its inefficiencies, its lack of development on the race strategy side, likely due to the engine superiority and probably driver caliber superiority they've had since the new turbocharged formula came online. I mean, if you look at how much of a sledgehammer their overall power unit has been, not as if they haven't had to make the right calls, Sunday afternoon, but for the most part, with a big horsepower advantage in Lewis and Nico, I don't know if they've ever really had to sit down and lose sleep and get headaches trying to figure out how to beat the rest of the field through strategic mastery. And I look at this season and you see, well, the Ferrari's awful good. I don't know if Mercedes had enough running, or at least as much as they would have wanted on Pirelli's various tire compounds to feel confident to start the year. It just seems to me that beyond the skills that they have and the quality of their car, seems to me that Ferrari, the team which has really had to rely on strategic thinking to beat or try and get up onto the podium for a few years now, do you think we're seeing laziness or lack of development on that side?
No, I think... You know, we saw even with Mercedes in the ascendancy, I think we saw some moments where the strategy fell down. You look back 2 years in Monaco and what happened there, and, you know, Toto blaming that on, the algorithm was wrong or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, dude, just use your eyes. We're under virtual safety car, then proper safety car comes out, and the gaps that you thought were there were not there, and all you needed to do was look over the edge of the pit wall and you would have seen what the gap was. I think the problem that Mercedes, to me, they don't see it as an issue, and they never have, and they've been very proud of their strategic thinking and the way that they handled Lewis and Nico. But I've always considered there to be something of an issue that the team has always employed sole strategist to deal with both drivers, because I don't see how you do that. I don't see how you are able then to put in play something that favors both drivers. It's only ever going to favor one. They have dropped the ball on a couple of occasions. And I think they spent so long over the last 3 years just solely being focused on themselves that sometimes when, for example, Malaysia, where Sebastian won 2 years ago on his second or third race with Ferrari, Mercedes was so concerned with themselves and what they were doing that they completely overlooked what Ferrari was doing, and Ferrari stole the race win from under them. Now the situation is very different. They're no longer in the ascendancy. They have a driver in Valtteri who is still trying to get up to the same level as Lewis, and who at present lacks a couple of tenths. But we'll get into Valtteri a little bit later, if we can. I think from a strategic perspective, it's very difficult because the Ferrari is faster in race conditions. And also, the gap in pace between the compound tires is far closer this year than it was before. So that ability to do something interesting with strategy by employing a different number of pit stops, running the super soft when everybody else is running the soft, it's not as marked as it was last year or the year before. You don't get that advantage by rolling the dice and doing an alternate strategy. It's just, it doesn't pay back like it did. So that's an issue. I think that's a real issue at the moment, and that's why we're not seeing, so many wildly different strategies in the races. It's just quite simply, in Bahrain, everybody except for Pascal Wehrlein, two stopped. It was just the decision of, do you do your second stint on the super soft and run short and then run the end of the race on the soft, or do you do a long second stint on the soft and a short final stint on the super soft? And that was literally the only difference in strategy between all of the teams. That it was a two-stopper, but do you go super soft, soft, or super soft, soft, super soft? And that's it, man. And the maths is the maths. There is the quickest way to get to the flag, and that's it. You know how quick your car is on what tire. You work your strategy out dependent upon those parameters. And the maths doesn't lie. And the maths doesn't change. It's always the same. And so because of that, they're relying on their maths. They're relying on the algorithms. And for as long as they are doing that, the ability for human error decreases. So the ability for strategic error decreases, and you get essentially a bit of a foregone conclusion.
The strange part is looking and seeing Vettel in an incredibly strong car, Lewis in an incredibly strong car, and just having the feeling that in the one area that is out, largely out of their control. I mean, it's not as if either of them could, push back and say, no, I think we need to run longer, stop sooner, go to a two-stop, Obviously, the driver has some input, but it's just strange to me that in the one area where you truly have to bring the entire team element into deciding, to your point, how quickly you get to the checkered flag, seen a bit of an imbalance. One that, I get some readers who say they should get rid of all this, one fuel tank, one set of tires, just balls out from start to finish, nothing in between. I enjoy the strategy part. I think a lot of people enjoy the strategy part. Just strange to me where at least two out of the first three races we can say, I don't know if the winner was there because the other driver, Hamilton was deficient, or if the team did not arm its driver with the best strategy to at least give him a better shot of vying for the win.
The big question mark in Bahrain for me was over Valtteri, he was on the same tyre strategy as Sebastian. So when Sebastian pits from P2 to get the undercut, you would assume that they would bring Valtteri in on the next lap to try and avoid that undercut, and they didn't. They kept him out, but still sent him out on the super softs. Once the safety car came out, so he was on the same strategy. Now, if the safety car hadn't come out, Valtteri would have been way behind by the time he changed onto those super soft tires and completely unable to mount any type of challenge to Sebastian at all. And if Max Verstappen hadn't have crashed, thus bringing out the safety car, then I think Max would have been up in P2. And both Mercedes drivers would have fallen even further behind. So I think that was an issue. Valtteri didn't have the pace all day, but I think his car was very much set up for a qualifying. You could see he had a whole load of front end on it. And even without the problem on the grid that saw the tire pressures at the rear too high at race start for Valtteri. I still think he would have struggled, and he showed that he struggled all day. The car just had too much front end from my eye, anyway. That's what I believe. You see how good Lewis was towards the end of the race, and how blistering he was, and had Valtteri had a more neutral setup on the car, I think, I'm not going to say he would have been able to turn those kind of laps, because that was special what we saw out of Lewis. But again, we're in a situation where two races in a row now, the safety car, which we so, for such a long time, we relied on the safety car to spice up a race and give us some action. The safety car has actually robbed us of that wheel-to-wheel fight between Seb and Lewis that we all want to see. Because I think, on a day when nothing goes awry, the Ferrari and the Mercedes will be quite evenly matched in race pace. But we won't know that until we see them go wheel-to-wheel. And that's only going to happen if a safety car doesn't come out and spoil it all.
Damn safety cars. Well, let me ask the dumb and landmine-filled question to close. Three races in, any surprises so far, be it teams or drivers ascending, descending, overachieving, or falling flat when you did not expect?
We remember in pre-season, and we talked about the different design philosophies on the cars.
Yeah.
And we said, you look at the Red Bull, and if you're doing something different to Adrian Newey, chances are you're doing it wrong. Yeah, that was kind of the wrong thing to say, because it turns out that Adrian Newey's dropped the ball a bit, and that car's not where it needs to be, and that it's not just the Renault power unit that's holding it back. They're bringing major aero upgrades to the car that will, from what I hear, turn it into almost a B-spec car by the time we get into the European season. So real big ball dropping there over in Milton Keynes. So that's been a surprise, that in a year when all the importance was placed on aero, that Newey would get it a little bit wrong. I think as well that the job that Mattia Binotto's done over at Ferrari, that SF70H is a phenomenal piece of kit. So clever, just a really intelligent use of the regulations, some of it borderline, and just smart, really, really smart. I think the how close the midfield is has been a big surprise, just really how close it is. And the fact that Force India don't appear to have mega pace over one lap, but are now 3-for-3 double point scoring this season with their two drivers. And conversely, that the Renault is so good over one lap, but absolutely woeful in the race. So that's interesting. McLaren is exactly where we thought it would be. I think it's going to be a great year. I think it's going to be really good fun. And the first three races have been exciting. We've seen passes pulled off, not because DRS has made it simple and a slam dunk to just fly past somebody, but because DRS has allowed someone to catch up and then make a move a couple of corners later, which is what it should always have been for.
Last question. Any idea where we can buy some cartoon anvil repellent to help out our friend Kevin Magnussen? Because it sure seems like it's followed him from his old team to his new team this year.
Yeah, although don't forget, he scored points in China, which was cool. So I think, once those little reliability woes just kind of, move on from Haas, they'll be looking good, because that car's damn fast. And, Grosjean scored points for the first time in Bahrain. Magnussen scored points in China. So Haas has already got over the issues they had last year, which was only one driver scoring points. They've got both of them scoring points now. So that's good news.
Amen.
And that was my man Will Buxton from NBCSN sharing his thoughts on a variety of topics related to the 2017 Formula One season, as well as our boy Mr. Alonso coming to Indianapolis. Get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast when it is fresh out of the oven on iTunes. We also have a Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page where we've archived 138, 39-ish episodes so far, so you can sign up there, and would definitely appreciate sharing, liking, doing whatever you might be inclined to do to spread the word on our little podcast. So, as always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. Thanks for listening.